Hello, everyone, and welcome to Classic Gaming Today, where we take a look at the gaming experiences of the past through the eyes of the present. I'm your host, Tony, and today we're going to look at Night Trap, a full-motion video, or FMV, interactive movie, developed by Digital Pictures and published by Sega for the Sega CD home console in 1992, with various ports and eventually remasters following in later years. We're going to talk about that game in just a couple minutes, but first, as is usual, just a little bit of housekeeping up front. This is episode number 77. I'm excited to be here. I hope all of you are as well. If you'd like to reach out, let me know how I'm doing, provide feedback, comments, suggestions, or just talk about classic games and technology in general, I would love to hear from you, and there are a few ways you can reach out. I have an X account with the handle @ClassicGamingT, I have an email address, which is ClassicGamingToday@gmail.com, and we have a Discord server. The link is in the show notes. Discord is the best way to get in touch with me and the rest of the community around this podcast. We have a ton of fun out on Discord. We have weekly gaming challenges, monthly gaming challenges, prizes, rewards, discussions. It's all out there. I highly encourage you all to check it out. I also highly encourage you all to check out our Patreon. It is patreon.com/classicgamingtoday. So if you want even more Classic Gaming Today goodness, including a Patreon-exclusive bi-weekly podcast expansion pack, patreon.com/classicgamingtoday is where it's at. I'd also like to give a shout-out to our Pantheon patrons. They are ISO, Rich Senewall, David Morton, and Sam Twardowski. Thank you guys for supporting the show. Thank you all for supporting the show, whether you contribute monetarily or simply listen on a regular basis. I truly do appreciate all of the support. For anyone who may be new, welcome. I just want to give a brief overview of the anatomy of an episode because, for the most part, all of our episodes follow a very similar format and structure. We will always start by talking about the history of the game in question, the historical context, how was the game made, why was the game made, and then we move into a pseudo-review kind of section. And I say pseudo-review because it's not like we assign a numerical ranking or star counts or anything like that, but we do talk about every single game from several different perspectives. We take a look at the graphics. How does the game look? The sound and music. How does the game sound? The narrative and or story, if the game has one. Playability and controls, and overall feel. What does it feel like to play the game today versus when it was released 20, 30, maybe even 40 plus years ago? We do all of that to reach a verdict as far as how well the game holds up today. And to do that, we assign each game to one of several categories. At the very top of our list is the Pantheon of Classic Gaming. If a game reaches the Pantheon, you know it is that darn good. It is a certifiable classic. You should go out of your way to play those games today. Just beyond the Pantheon are our golden oldies. These are still really good games. I still highly recommend them, especially if you enjoy the genre in which the game exists. By all means, you should have a good time. They are not quite Pantheon level, but they're still really worthwhile experiences, and I still highly encourage you all to play them today. Beyond the golden oldies, we reach our mediocre mentions. This is where we start getting into the realm of games that I cannot recommend to the broad population. They might have aged a little bit, might have had a couple of issues to begin with. You may still have a good time, especially if you enjoy the genre in which the game lives. By all means, go for it. But I cannot recommend these to the broad game-playing population. And then beyond the mediocre mentions, we reach the footnotes. These are the games that are best left in the annals of history. I have played them, so you don't have to. I cannot recommend anyone play these titles today. They have either aged incredibly poorly, or they may not have been all that great to begin with. With that out of the way, we're going to start talking about the game of the day. That is Night Trap.
All right, Mike, I think we've seen enough of that.
Wow, it's got to be the strangest thing I've ever seen.
I hear that.
Just got this in last night.
All right, listen up.
The students that have been coming up to work the resort on this side of the lake have been disappearing right and left.
Local authorities didn't have a clue until our surveillance teams tapped into the winery house right there and taped everything you just saw.
What about the cameras and the traps?
Probably security.
What?
We suspect they're using the winery house as a cover, and they're getting anyone who stumbles onto their scheme, whatever that is.
Come on.
This is Kelly.
Kid.
Come on, isn't she a little young?
She's young. She's one of our best.
She'll also be working inside. And remember, no one goes in until we get the signal from her.
I want to know more about these traps.
Yeah.
That's one thing we've got going for us.
How's that?
One of our guys put an override on the camera cable unit here in the back hallway.
Which means...
Night Trap is an FMV interactive movie developed by Digital Pictures and published by Sega for the Sega CD home console in 1992, with ports and remasters following in later years. Before we can talk about Night Trap, though, we have to address the sewer rat-sized elephant in the room, as this is the one-year anniversary of our episode on Sewer Shark, the Digital Pictures FMV title that defied the odds to become one of our golden oldies, despite the belief by many people that FMV titles, and the use of FMV in gaming in general, was a primarily 1990s gaming fad that should never have happened. I know I may be in the minority, but for those who may be unaware, I absolutely love full-motion video games. I have a soft spot for even the cheesiest, most poorly acted FMV titles. And you know what? Over the last 70-something episodes and multiple gaming challenges out on Discord, I've ended up converting a chunk of people over to my way of thinking. Or, at the very least, I've opened them up to the possibility that not every FMV game is bad. Call it recognition of a previously hidden truth or Stockholm Syndrome, whichever you prefer, but suffice it to say, there are people beyond myself that have had some fun with FMV titles. From a personal perspective, I think most of you know that I'm a huge proponent of FMV in gaming, and I believe it represents a pivotal moment in the evolution of video game narratives. While I'd never argue that the majority of FMV titles are true quality entertainment, the use of real actors and video in games showed that the computer and video game market was interested in moving beyond the gameplay-driven roots of the industry and would instead begin placing greater emphasis on storylines and plot development. It was actually an indication that the games industry was maturing and trying to reach an even broader audience, which at the end of the day is beneficial to all involved. I mention all of this to say that for longtime listeners, part of our upcoming discussion is going to be familiar, as a lot of the history behind Night Trap's creation mirrors that of Sewer Shark, and the genesis of full motion video titles as a genre of game shares one singular origin story. But in order to ensure that each episode of our podcast can stand alone, we need to repeat a little bit of history along the way. So with that said, let's talk a bit about the origins of full motion video in gaming. The first full-motion video games were released in arcades in the early 80s as a means of playing a form of animated movie on arcade hardware, and the player would often be prompted to take some sort of action that would affect how that video would play out, or to which scene the video would jump to. In this way, full-motion video games in arcades were effectively a string of quick-time events, or QTEs, with the player given little choice as to how the story played out, short of being able to avoid death. Now you might be asking, what kind of technology was used to house the arcade machine's video, as most recognize that CD-ROM technology wasn't really on anyone's radar until the late 80s, and wasn't utilized for full-motion video until the CD-ROM craze of the 1990s. Similarly, the memory chips used in most consoles and arcades at the time just didn't have enough capacity to store the amount of data required by full-motion video content. So instead, arcade manufacturers turned to another video disc standard of the time, the high-quality Laserdisc format. Now, I say high-quality because for the early 80s, Laserdisc was pretty much the best possible format for both audio and video production, and Laserdisc players of the time were extremely expensive and weren't nearly as pervasive as the video cassette recorders, or VCRs, that almost every household had at least one of. Laserdisc offered a number of benefits over the VCR format, one being the quality of video, as the format had a video resolution consisting of 425 horizontal lines, which compared to video cassette's relatively paltry 240 horizontal display lines was a big bump. But beyond the quality offered by the video format, the main reason Laserdiscs were used in early full motion video arcade titles was because it allowed for random seeks and jumps from scene to scene, while VCRs, for those who might be unaware, were effectively linear devices. Meaning, if you wanted to skip past a certain scene in a movie, you couldn't just click next, you had to hit fast forward and wait while the tape advanced rapidly through whatever scene was playing. Using a linear format for games that allow for various user inputs wouldn't really work to provide a positive experience for players, and the reason for that comes down to player choice. To illustrate why that is, let's take a look at one of the early Laserdisc arcade games, Dragon's Lair, and how the actions in that game play out. We're going to discuss Dragon's Lair in only the simplest terms here, purely as an illustration of early FMV gaming, And if you want to know more about Dragon's Lair specifically, check out the episode we did last year, which was focused entirely on Dragon's Lair. Anyway, in Dragon's Lair, you play a knight named Dirk the Daring, who is on a quest to save a princess named Daphne from certain doom. In order to progress through the game and save the princess, you have to traverse a series of different scenes and dangerous situations, all playing out in a very cartoon-like animated video. And the way it works is, at various points in the video, you'll be presented with an opportunity to take one of several options. As in the original iteration of the arcade game, there were no button prompts on the screen to help guide your inputs. In fact, there wasn't even any indication of when you were supposed to take an action. Instead, you would simply observe the video and hit one of four directional inputs on your joystick or swing your sword whenever you thought the scene being played might warrant some degree of interaction. Assuming you chose correctly, the Laserdisc player would automatically jump to the location on the disc that corresponded to the successful choice. If you choose the wrong action, the Laserdisc player would similarly jump to the location on the disc that corresponded to that incorrect choice, which might make the gameplay cut down a different path, or potentially lead to your death, which was the case more often than not. Because of the need to jump from scene to scene quickly, and with as little delay as possible, using laser discs for the game makes perfect sense, and the nearly instantaneous video playback, regardless of your choices, ended up creating what felt like a personalized cartoon driven entirely by your own actions, whether right or wrong. If, however, video cassettes were used instead of laser discs, then the act of jumping from scene to scene wouldn't really exist due to the linearity of the format. If the player were to take the action that doesn't immediately follow the currently playing scene, then he or she would have to wait for the video cassette to fast forward or rewind before the next scene would begin to play. This simply would not be all that great to experience as a player. Can you imagine playing a game that was effectively a series of 5 to 10 second gameplay snippets, followed by 20 seconds or more worth of load time? That would be absolutely awful, and if that's what FMV games would have had to rely on, there is no doubt they would have died before they ever attained any degree of popularity. So, quick-time event-driven titles like Dragon's Lair were one type of full-motion video game prevalent in early arcade machines, but there were other ways full-motion video was being used at the time, most notably as background scenery for games that were themselves effectively graphical overlays over that scenery. As a hypothetical example, let's say you're making a Star Wars game, and you want to recreate the Death Star run made famous in the first Star Wars film, which was Episode 4. An arcade machine of the time wouldn't really have the power to create three-dimensional graphics, texture maps, anti-aliasing, and all of the other graphical bells and whistles to make you feel like you're really in an X-Wing attacking a Death Star. But it could have the ability to play back a video of the Death Star run, while at the same time adding graphics on top of that video depicting TIE fighters, lasers, and other targets that you could position your crosshair over and shoot, causing those targets to explode. Now, the video in the scene would never really change, short of potentially jumping from one scene to another, similar to how QuickTime event-driven games work, but the graphics being overlaid on the scene can change, and you can potentially introduce more interesting controls, like targeting systems, than simply pressing a direction or action button and having a scene play out in front of you. In this way, you can maintain the feeling of realism and graphical fidelity prevalent with full-motion video, while at the same time allowing for more varied gameplay elements that provide deeper levels of immersion for the player. It's probably fairly obvious, but to be clear, if you wanted to play FMV games in the 80s, you pretty much had to do so at the arcades, as those were the only machines that had the power and equipment necessary to deliver a worthwhile FMV gaming experience. But that doesn't mean there weren't attempts to bring that technology into the home, with one of the earliest examples being a failed videocassette gaming experiment called the Control Vision Console, otherwise known as Project Nemo. Recall our discussion from a little bit ago related to how videocassettes are not a good medium for interactive experiences, due primarily to the fact that the videocassette is a linear format. But what if you could have a linear experience while still allowing scenes to change immediately, not through random jumping to different sections of a disc, but by allowing one of multiple video streams to be played at any one time, while other video streams played concurrently but out of the player's sight? This, at a high level, is exactly what the Control Vision attempted to do. The ColecoVision was a home console that was being developed by Hasbro, Nolan Bushnell, who was the founder of Atari, and a number of other video game industry visionaries, including a man named Tom Zito back in 1985. It was designed to utilize video cassettes as its main format, and it was, by extension, designed to utilize full motion video across all of its games. More specifically, the goal was to use video shot just like a movie, with real actors, but allow players to interact with that video, and therefore cause each game to play out differently based on user input. The way that the team went about doing this is, from my perspective, nothing short of ingenious, but to understand the technology behind the console, we have to dive pretty deep into VHS cassettes and the way cathode ray tube or CRT televisions process data. When an image is displayed on a CRT television, it's actually not the full image that you see at any given time, but it's really half of an image. Take, for example, a CRT with 480 lines of horizontal resolution. Every 1/60th of a second, the electron gun inside the television paints 240 lines to the television screen, and the next 1/60th of a second, the remaining 240 lines are painted to the screen. This alternating pattern continues, and because it's so fast, the human eye cannot really perceive the difference in horizontal lines being created. And for reference, that means that most televisions were displaying things at 60 frames per second. The ColecoVision team understood this limitation and wondered, what would happen if we controlled playback such that we used two discrete video streams, one stored in the first 240 lines printed to the television, and the next stored in the remaining 240 lines, but only displayed one set of lines to the end user at any given time? Doing so would allow for the illusion of multi-track playback, even in a linear-based system like video cassettes. In this example, two discrete video streams can be played back at the exact same time, with the console determining which set of 240 lines would actually be displayed to the player. But if you manipulate the frame rate, it becomes possible to decompose those two video streams into even more concurrent video streams. So, while you might be able to store two concurrent streams of video at 60 frames per second, you could store four concurrent video streams at 30 frames per second. This, in turn, enabled immediate scene switching using a medium that would otherwise require sequential fast-forwarding or rewinding. Put another way, when the player took an action that would change the scene of the game, the console would switch to a different set of lines, representing an individual video stream, and, like magic, a new scene would begin playing on the screen. There was no need to fast forward or seek out the appropriate scene because all of the various scenes available to the player were running concurrently with one another. So the actual story playing out was pretty much entirely linear, as you would expect given the video cassette format, but players could choose to focus on different scenes at any given time, which embedded a degree of interactivity that would otherwise have been impossible on analog video cassettes. While the ColecoVision console was an attempt to take that innovative video cassette playback technology and apply it to a gaming use case, the actual technology originated outside of the game industry entirely, having been created by an engineer who had a chance encounter with Tom Zito and ended up demonstrating the concept to him. Zito loved the idea, and the people he was working with thought that it had merit, so they decided to try to turn it into a gaming-based proof of concept. There was only one question. What should that proof of concept really be focused on? We've already discussed a couple of different forms of full motion video games that had been prevalent in arcades of the time, and now Zito and the team had to figure out what the best demonstration of their new VHS-based system would be. And here, inspiration would come from a somewhat unlikely place, at least as it relates to video games, the world of stage plays. While many video game experiences resulted from licensed movies and television shows, you don't really hear about plays driving a ton of inspiration in the video game space. But for the team behind the ColecoVision console, things would be different, as they had an opportunity to see a 1981 play named Tamara several times in 1985, and they were immediately struck by a flash of inspiration. Tamara was a play that can best be described as experimental, and is certainly a unique production in the theater industry. For those who may not have had an opportunity to see a play in a theater, a traditional play involves a single stage upon which actors perform, in real time, various scenes over a series of acts, with the stage providing the focal point that the audience is meant to direct their attention towards. Occasionally, plays deviate from that formula by having actors perform in the audience, but even in those instances, there is typically one singular story and scene that is playing out at any given time. Tamara was an entirely different kind of experience, in that rather than having a single scene play out at a time, in Tamara, 13 different stories would play out at the same time, and it was up to the audience to determine which story each individual wanted to pay attention to, and which ones they wanted to ignore. That might sound strange, or perhaps overwhelming, until you realize that the way this play is typically performed is by using an actual house, where different actors inhabit different rooms of the house, and audience members are invited to walk around each of the rooms, interacting with the actors and sometimes even becoming part of the play themselves. The thing is, though, because there were multiple parallel stories taking place at a single time, it would be impossible to witness everything going on in the play in one sitting, or I guess standing. So theatergoers would often attend the play multiple times, observing different rooms and stories each time, in an effort to fully understand the true meaning and overarching story of the play's narrative. Which is why, when members of the Control Vision team had an opportunity to see the play in 1985, they were immediately intrigued and would return to watch the play several times over the course of a single weekend, each time learning more about the underlying stories and characters. And it was this parallel story kind of structure that the team believed would be a perfect example of their Control Vision hardware, which is why shortly after viewing that play, they created the interactive demo known as Scene of the Crime as a means of showing exactly what that technology could do. Scene of the Crime would offer players the ability to interact with multiple camera feeds, switching between them at will, allowing players to dive deeper into certain aspects of the story while other parts continue to play out along a linear timeline. If that sounds confusing, think about it like this. When you hit play on the game, four distinct video tracks begin playing at once, each on a different video stream embedded in the video cassette. As you, the player, switch between the various feeds, different video tracks, which are really just frame offsets, are selected for display, effectively hiding the other concurrently running tracks. To you, it seems like the camera feeds are seamlessly jumping from one to the other. From a technology perspective, all it involved was displaying the appropriate combination of frame and 240 lines on the screen, and hiding the other streams as appropriate. This technology, while awesome sounding in theory, had some severe issues in practice. Most notably, in order to maintain the illusion of continuity across all disparate video streams, every individual track had to be perfectly synchronized, which introduced complexity into both the recording and editing process, as well as the final act of splicing all of the various video tracks together into a series of concurrently running streams. Despite those issues, though, the Control Vision team demonstrated the system and their prototype Scene of the Crime to toy manufacturer Hasbro in late 1986, a meeting which earned the team rave reviews and a good chunk of funding to begin developing full-fledged titles for the system. With money in hand, Zito and the rest of the team sat down to begin brainstorming what games they would create as their first experiences for the Control Vision console. And here, because the system was intended to be a video-driven console, it only made sense to attempt to attract current film distributors as potential partners, with an initial goal of creating an interactive movie based on the very popular A Nightmare on Elm Street film series, which involves a demonic presence, Freddy Krueger, haunting the dreams of various teens living on the titular residential street. This sounded like a perfect application of the Control Vision technology, so Zito and the rest of the team began negotiating with film production company New Line Cinema in the hopes of acquiring the Elm Street license. Unfortunately, those negotiations would eventually fall through, leaving Zito and the team without a license to use for their new game. So they decided to do the next best thing, which was to create an entirely original story focused on an eccentric billionaire who kept his fortune stored in his grand mansion, protected by a series of state-of-the-art traps and security systems to prevent any theft from potentially occurring. One weekend, the billionaire's daughter and several of her friends decide to stay overnight at the house, which of course is also the weekend that a team of highly skilled ninja burglars, yes, ninja burglars, decided to rob the billionaire's home. With only you, as the player, standing between those ninja thieves, a group of teenage girls, and billions of dollars, your job is to use surveillance cameras positioned around the house to observe each room and, at appropriate times, trigger the installed traps to capture the ninja robbers and save both the teenage slumber party goers as well as the billionaire's vast fortune. That concept would evolve a bit from this original idea, eventually morphing from protecting a teenage slumber party from ninja burglars to protecting a teenage slumber party from vampiric creatures known as augurs. Though, as that vampire idea materialized, the team faced an unexpected challenge. Hasbro, who, like I said, was the primary investor behind the game and the ControlVision console itself, had a policy in place that any filmed footage could not feature what they called reproducible violence. Meaning, if the footage showed something that someone could conceivably do in the real world, it could not be used for the game. Now, I'm not sure how up to speed everyone is on vampiric practices, but typically, vampires drain the blood from their victims via a bite on the neck, which incidentally would fit into Hasbro's definition of reproducible violence. So the team needed to figure out how to use vampires, but not use their defining characteristic, which resulted in the augers becoming slow-moving creatures who, rather than biting and sucking the blood from a victim's neck, would instead use an odd contraption that effectively served the same function. But because that contraption didn't exist in the real world, it was totally safe to use in the game. This is definitely an interesting interpretation of Hasbro's rules. Regardless, the final concept for the game was agreed upon, and with that, production on the title that would eventually be known as Night Trap began in earnest. Over a period of 6 months, Night Trap would be filmed, edited, and programmed, with most of the time spent on actually splicing together all of the filmed footage into a usable format. Filming the footage for the game took around 16 days to complete, and would notably include actress Dana Plato in a starring role, who at the time was best known for her role in the family sitcom Different Strokes. Plato at the time was experiencing a fall from grace, as she was unfortunately stuck in the throes of addiction, which ended up manifesting itself in being difficult to work with while on set. Luckily, that didn't impact the filming schedule, because Plato ultimately wasn't in that many scenes directly. The augers, however, despite being nameless masked creatures, were prevalent throughout the game, and those characters would be played by a series of stunt people who, in an attempt to avoid real injury, developed an interesting walking style that was kind of a side-to-side, slightly hunched shamble, which ostensibly was done to make it so that they'd always be ready to fall into a trap. Now, I found that particularly interesting, because my assumption was that they would receive some sort of cue when a trap was about to be activated, but it sounds like maybe that didn't happen? If so, that's kind of awesome, and adds a whole new dimension to the footage that accompanies you trapping an auger in the game. Anyway, eventually, all of the principal photography would be completed, which meant it was now time to splice all of that footage together into a game, which proved to be challenging, as at any given time, four different video streams and stories were playing at the same time, all of which had to be synchronized in order to create the illusion of a free-flowing film. Interestingly, the final game would end up featuring 8 rooms, though only those previously mentioned 4 video streams would play at any point, meaning that 4 rooms would always be static, while 4 rooms would always have something with action. The static and action-driven rooms would change as the game played out, but that 4 and 4 rule would be maintained throughout the game. Once all of that programming and video splicing magic was finished, preparations would begin on releasing Night Trap for the ControlVision console, which alongside the full-motion video on-rail shooter SewerShark was intended to be a launch title for the system. Everything was pretty much ready to go, and then Hasbro pulled the plug on the console right before its launch in 1989. A result of the hardware being too expensive to produce and sell, and the technology being just a bit too tricky to work with. So, despite 2 games being pretty much ready to ship, all work would stop once the console launch was cancelled, and both Night Trap and SewerShark would end up stuck in limbo. With no alternative at the time, Tom Zito purchased the rights to the game, along with SewerShark, and stored everything in a Rhode Island warehouse, in the hopes that he would be able to revisit them again in the future. We'll now fast forward to 1991, where a relatively new format was beginning to take the computing and video game industry by storm. That format, of course, was the CD-ROM, a massive jump in storage technology that allowed for previously unheard-of amounts of data to be stored on a single disk, 650 megabytes to be precise. With the proliferation of the CD-ROM, and the adoption of the technology by console giant Sega for use with their forthcoming add-on system, the Sega CD, Tom Zito saw an opportunity. In 1991, he, along with several other members of the failed ControlVision team, decided to form a new company called Digital Pictures, whose focus was going to be creating full-motion video experiences for CD-ROM technology. CD-ROMs allowed for many of the same benefits as the Laserdisc technology that we had previously discussed, in that drives could skip to pretty much any part of the disc instantaneously, which effectively served as a more cost-effective mechanism for bringing FMV titles into the home. As Digital Pictures began considering what games to make first, the team recalled that not only had Tom Zito purchased the rights to both Night Trap and Sewer Shark, but he also had all of the original film and game assets locked away in a Rhode Island warehouse. The team therefore decided that they would focus on those titles first, and work on Night Trap resumed years after the game itself had originally been created. The good news for Zito and the team was that most of the time-consuming work was already complete. All they needed to do was figure out how to effectively port the title from the ControlVision to the Sega CD. Now, we've talked before about how Laserdiscs and CDs allow for skipping to different areas of the disc with little, if any, perceptible lag to the player. In reality, that's not entirely accurate. Most Laserdisc titles did in fact have a very short pause when jumping from scene to scene, and even though CD-ROMs were capable of immediate jumps, the speed of CD-ROM drives at the time, which equated to 150 kilobytes per second, otherwise known as single-speed drives, was not conducive to playing full-motion video sequences with any level of fidelity and smoothness. In order to make the experience better for the player, the Digital Pictures team basically recreated the ControlVision technology, albeit on a CD-ROM disc. Meaning, for Night Trap, four streams of video were being read from a single data stream, which meant that as video sequences shifted from one scene to the next, there was literally zero pause in the action. It all felt like a single integrated video. To accomplish that feat, the team had to create their own video format and codec, because the technology for creating this kind of fast-paced, fully integrated video stream just didn't exist at the time. This codec would be improved throughout the years, and would be utilized in a number of Digital Pictures' future FMV titles. As it relates to Night Trap, the end result was that to the player, everything was entirely seamless, and they could literally choose to view any room, at any time, and see a continuous, fully synchronized video stream. Tom Zito's vision of having a true interactive movie where players control the action was about to come true. Night Trap would end up being a launch day title for the Sega CD in North America, hitting the market on October 15, 1992, and, along with Sewer Shark, represents the first instances of a home console title using full motion video as the primary mechanic in a game. That's right. Night Trap, Sewer Shark, and Digital Pictures were trailblazers in the video game industry. There was just one problem. Right around the time that Night Trap was released, the United States, and other areas of the world, were going through a period of self-reflection as it related to the rapidly developing and maturing video game industry. The video games of the 80s, which were primarily pixel-styled affairs designed to cater to younger players, were rapidly being replaced by edgier titles that, rather than depicting cute scenes to admire, were instead throwing showers of blood at players, as most prominently seen in titles like Doom and Mortal Kombat. Night Trap, however, posed a different threat. While the on-screen violence was decidedly tamer than gorier titles, Night Trap was a full-motion video game, which for many senators in the U.S. government represented something that was a bit too real, especially considering the game's content, which included young women clothed in slightly revealing lingerie and, at one point, a bra. And those young women were being attacked by vampiric creatures. Obviously, something had to be done to save the youth of the world. So, a series of Senate hearings were held, where Night Trap and its more mature cousins would effectively stand trial while a number of government officials, video game luminaries, and others would discuss the impact of such titles on children, who many believed were still the primary audience for video games. For anyone who lived through this period of history, you likely recognize that the whole situation was blown completely out of proportion. And oftentimes, different officials would demonstrate their own ignorance by explaining the concept of Night Trap as being what amounted to a vampire simulator. They claimed that the purpose of Night Trap was for you, the player, to attack and abduct young women. This obviously was not true at all, as your real purpose in Night Trap is to save those young women from their would-be attackers. Regardless, the damage was done, and Night Trap gained a level of infamy that very few games in history can claim. The end result of all this controversy was the creation of the Entertainment Software Ratings Board, or ESRB, in 1994, which is the United States organization responsible for rating games based on their content in an effort to categorize titles as either being suitable for the entire population or restricted to more mature gamers. While the ESRB is an American organization, other similar groups would pop up around the world, driven largely by the same concerns as were raised by the United States government. Despite that controversy, or perhaps because of that controversy, sales for the game ended up increasing, and Night Trap would go on to sell 400,000 copies in the years following its release, which is pretty impressive considering major toy retailers like Toys R Us refused to sell the title in their stores. From a critical perspective, the game would receive mixed reviews. While some people praised the fact that playing a truly interactive movie was innovative and technologically advanced, many others complained that the game's lack of direct interactivity made it feel less like a game and more like a passive experience. The game's B-movie-styled narrative also called division amongst the critical community, as some people loved the quirky charm of the title, while others declared that the acting and story were both subpar. I'll let you know what I think about the game in just a little bit, but suffice it to say, for many, Night Trap was written off shortly after its release as a gimmick, both because of its reliance on full-motion video gameplay, and also because of the controversy it stirred, which some people believe to be entirely intentional. Despite being ported to a number of different systems, Night Trap would end up losing a bit of popularity over the years, with most people only playing it ironically, as opposed to looking at it as a title to experience for the simple joy of playing a game. For many years, it looked like Night Trap would slip out of the spotlight entirely. That would all change in 2014, though, when some of the original team behind Night Trap, including lead designer James Riley, would put forward a Kickstarter for a remastered version of the game, complete with higher quality visuals and potentially even a brand new sequel. Unfortunately for FMV fans, that Kickstarter failed miserably, with only $40,000 of the $330,000 goal pledged by the end of the campaign. For a while, it looked like there truly was no desire to revisit Night Trap. The community just wasn't there, or at least there weren't enough people who wanted to actually spend money on an early 90s FMV revival. Luckily, in 2016, a software developer named Tyler Hogel, who was in the process of remastering a number of the old Digital Pictures FMV titles from the Sega CD era, was able to get a tech demo for a remastered Night Trap working on a smartphone. He took that demo and began socializing it, eventually working with both Tom Zito and James Riley to take that prototype and turn it into a full-fledged re-release, with updated visuals, user interface elements, and a number of extras included. That re-release would be announced as Night Trap 25th Anniversary Edition in April of 2017, and would come out on pretty much every modern system and computer platform in the months that followed. Perhaps most ironically, the remastered version of Night Trap would also release for the Nintendo Switch, despite the fact that during the congressional hearings in the early 90s, various Nintendo leaders declared that a game like Night Trap would never appear on a Nintendo system. It's kind of funny how things change over time, and I guess it goes to show you, never say never. Night Trap, despite being a controversial FMV-based title, certainly has a spot in video game history, as does the company that created it, Digital Pictures. Digital Pictures would go on to be one of the premier FMV developers of the 90s, releasing 17 different FMV titles over the course of the decade across a wide variety of focus areas, including sports games, shooters, music titles, and others. Eventually, though, FMV titles fell out of favor, which had a devastating impact on Digital Pictures, eventually causing the company to be acquired by another company, Cyber Cinema Interactive. That company had intended to re-release Digital Pictures titles on DVD, but that ended up not happening. Though, like I mentioned, we have seen a bit of a resurgence of the old Digital Pictures game catalog, with Tyler Hogel releasing several remasters of various games over the last 6 years, including re-releases for Double Switch, Corpse Killer, Ground Zero Texas, Quarterback Attack, and Kids on Sight, in addition to, of course, Night Trap. With Night Trap, you have a title that was one of the first true console FMV experiences, which of course was a controversial title that has both its fans and critics, even today. Regardless of how you feel about FMV and gaming, or your perception about Night Trap in particular, I do believe that everyone should at least have an open mind when looking at and playing these titles. Even as an FMV fan, I recognize that there are plenty of FMV games that are simply not good. But from my perspective, Night Trap is a little bit different. It may not have been the most influential game ever created, and it may have gained a reputation for being one of the worst games ever, at least in some circles, but from my perspective, Night Trap should be better respected. It's certainly not the best game ever made, but I do believe that Night Trap, as a truly unique early 90s gaming experience, is a title that absolutely deserves to be remembered.
Megan, this isn't gonna work. You're not scaring me. Wait, what are you doing now?
We are now going to shift to start talking about what it feels like to play Night Trap today versus when it was released over 30 years ago. So Night Trap, like we've talked about, is a full motion video game that tasks you with keeping a group of slumber partying young women safe from an onslaught of vampiric beings known as augurs. The way you accomplish that task is via the use of a security system of sorts, with the general concept being the house you're observing has been fitted with a number of surveillance cameras, and the organization you work for, the Sega Control Attack Team, or SCAT, has hacked into the system and given you control over those cameras. At the same time, the house has also been outfitted with a number of traps, and it is your job to view the surveillance footage from the 8 rooms in and around the house, wait for augurs to enter a trap zone, and then trigger those traps to capture the augurs and keep the women in the house safe. As with many interactive movies of the time, the majority of the gameplay is relatively simple, as most of your time with the game is spent watching pre-recorded video sequences and pressing a button at the right time, very similar in some respects to the gameplay from the arcade classic Dragon's Lair. Night Trap, though, actually has some additional elements included that work to add additional interactivity to keep you on your toes. For one, as you play the game, you're not just responsible for watching a single video sequence play out in front of you. Instead, you're presented with a series of rooms, and you need to navigate between them, trying to figure out where there's some sort of scene playing out. In the original Sega CD version of the game, there was no indicator of which room a scene might be playing out in, which means finding an active scene relied mostly on trial and error, at least until you began learning the general sequence of the game's video sequences. Because in Night Trap, the game plays out the exact same way every single time you play it. There are different videos that may play depending on your ability or inability to capture augurs at the right time, and there are several endings you might eventually receive. But from a story perspective, there's effectively a singular path through the game. What that means is that success in Night Trap is dependent entirely on your ability to either memorize or write down the appropriate sequence of rooms to navigate between in order to capture the most possible augurs. And here, that sequence, and your ability to capture the bad guys, is vitally important, because the game has a series of threshold checks built into it that will look at the number of augurs you've captured at certain points in the game. If the number exceeds the game's threshold, then you continue playing. If the number is lower than what the game expects, then your SCAT leader will send you a message and disconnect your video feed, effectively ending the game. Conceptually, that gameplay mechanic makes sense. There is just one issue, though. In order to capture the number of augurs necessary to succeed at the game, you have to effectively ignore the story almost entirely, because at any point in time, up to 4 different rooms might have some activity happening. Until near the end of the game, the general rule is that if you see a story scene playing out, you will almost invariably be missing out on capturing an auger or two, so the optimal gameplay move at that point is to navigate away from the scene, ignoring the story, and look for the room or rooms with augers shambling about. While you may not know where those augers are in the original Sega CD version of the game, you do always know when a new capturable auger exits the game world, because there's an auger counter that you'll see augment whenever a capturable auger escapes from the game. This, as you might imagine, is not always the most useful thing, as by the time you realize you should be capturing an auger, it's often too late. The remake did address this issue by having the capturable auger count increment when an auger enters the scene, as opposed to when they escape a scene, which is a minor tweak, but it is a tweak that makes the remake a good bit easier than the original version. Regardless of those counter shenanigans, assuming you navigate to the right room, your goal is to watch the augers move about until they enter a trap zone, at which point a light will flash on your screen, indicating that the trap should be triggered, which you accomplish by pressing the B button on your controller. If you time your button press accurately enough, you'll capture the auger, or augers, in the scene. If you're not accurate or timely enough, then the auger will escape. It's important to note, though, that not every auger in a given scene can be captured at the moment you see them, as sometimes they move from room to room. The cool thing here, though, is that each of the rooms are synchronized with each other, so if you see an auger or a main character move from one room to an adjacent room, you can continue to follow their movements by switching to the video feed for that new room. I really did think this was a nice touch and added a layer of cohesion and consistency to the game world that made the game feel more real, so to speak, as opposed to simply a series of disjointed video streams that you can navigate between. Beyond missing the trigger to capture an auger, there's actually another fail condition that could potentially pop up, and that involves the active security code system integrated with the gameplay. At certain points in the story, a scene will play out in one of the rooms where a couple of characters will speak with each other, and one will mention needing to change the security code. These scenes are incredibly important to discover, as if you don't have the right security code set, which in this case is one of several different colors, then your traps will not trigger, no matter how accurate your button press is. These are pretty much some of the most important scenes in the game, and they will always occur at the same time, in the same room, in every single playthrough you experience. What changes, though, is the security code that the characters choose, which is entirely random each time you play the game. What that means is that you cannot rely on simply changing your security code to a predefined value once the game clock hits the prescribed time. You need to watch the predefined scenes to hear which random code you need to set your system to. It's an interesting mechanic, and one designed to keep gameplay more engaging, which in this case, I think works, since this is one of the few ways that the game changes from playthrough to playthrough. Is it the most amazing mechanic ever? No, it's not, but it is a nice addition to further test your time management skills. And speaking of time management, that's pretty much the name of the game here, as like I mentioned, the only way you'll eventually beat the game is by figuring out the right sequence of rooms and scenes to view in order to maximize your auger capture count. What I ended up doing is grabbing a trusty pen and piece of paper and literally documenting the sequence of room shifts that resulted in an auger being captured. I ended up playing the game multiple times to get the timing down, and while I never achieved a perfect run, I did figure out enough of the sequence to beat the game and save everyone involved, which for me was 100% good enough. I should also note that if you play the 25th anniversary remaster, the act of navigating scenes is dramatically improved, as rather than viewing an icon of each room, you actually get to see a mini video stream of each room concurrently with every other video stream. So you can keep your eye on the list of rooms, and if you notice movement, you can navigate there, capture your augers, and then navigate to the next room that has a non-story scene going on. Even playing the remaster, though, I never got a perfect run. Figuring out the timing is a surprisingly fun part of the experience, and even though you may never see the full story short of looking it up on YouTube, I still enjoyed the act of playing the game, despite the repeated playthroughs required to eventually be successful. And just to reiterate, if you are truly trying to beat Night Trap independently, it will take you a number of playthroughs to figure out good enough timing to continue to progress through the story. And other than a mid-story checkpoint, there are no autosaves or any other form of continues built into the game. When you fail, you either restart right at the beginning, or you restart at the midway point, which I could see some people feeling is a bit tedious. That being said, the entire game is maybe 30 or so minutes long, so even if you do have to restart the game multiple times, it's not all that bad, and as you get progressively better at the game, you may find yourself entering a state of simple relaxation, as your memory starts to take over and you simply navigate room to room, capturing augers. It may sound strange, but I know this happened to me a couple times while playing, and honestly, it was kinda nice after playing some pretty darn challenging games recently. We're going to talk more about the specific aspects of Night Trap in just a couple minutes, but first, as we have to do, always, we've got to look at the back of the box. Because, as you all know, I love looking out the back of the box for these games. I love learning how different companies marketed their titles and tried to get you to buy these games in the stores. Now, around this time, we did not have a pervasive internet. We did not have YouTube to look up gameplay videos. Most of the time when we made a buying decision, it was either based on word of mouth, or things we might have seen in magazines and reviews, or what the box looked like. And a lot of times, it was really based on what the box looked like. Did the front of the box look cool? Did the back of the box sound cool? If so, you were going to buy the game. Now, Night Trap, because it did have that controversy we talked about, was a little bit different, at least after its release, because I think a lot of people probably knew what Night Trap was simply because of how much controversy and press attention it was getting in the Senate hearings and other hearings around the world. But typically speaking, when you made a buying decision back around this time, a lot of it was based on what the box looked like. So, for Night Trap, for the Sega CD, the back of the box says, "The next generation of video games on Sega CD." Night Trap is the first CD title with continuous full motion video and audio. It plays like a movie with hours of awesome gameplay. Get two CDs packed with sinister scenes and live action video. Vanishing Coeds, Bloodless Bodies, Mysterious Intruders. As a secret commando for SCAT, the Sega Control Attack Team, your mission's a time bomb. Five beautiful coeds are being stalked in an eerie estate. Hooded intruders are invading the mansion with blood on their minds. Watch the murderous action from hidden cameras in eight different rooms. Catch the intruders as they track their victims. Miss your chance, and the coeds are lost forever. You gotta play it to believe it. And then there are some screenshots from the game itself, and I've got to say, this game absolutely sold me, or the box rather, absolutely sold me on the game. You guys know I love full motion video games. And boy, did this make this sound like an interactive movie, which of course it is. But I would have been over the moon excited to buy this game when it first came out. Now, interestingly, I did have a Sega CD when it first came out. And I did love Sewer Shark, which was kinda Night Trap's sibling as far as game development goes, but I never did buy Night Trap, the original Sega CD game. I don't know why that is. Maybe the controversy thing kinda played into it. I don't quite recall exactly why I didn't pick it up, because I know if I had the opportunity to, based on what the box looked like and what the box showed and what the writing was and kinda how it made it all sound, I would have been all in on the experience. Anyway, let's move on and start talking about the more specific aspects of the game. We're going to start by talking about the graphics. As you might imagine, the graphics here are almost entirely full motion video based, and conceptually, that should mean the graphics are pretty lifelike. And yes, they do in fact present recordings of real people. But, and we've talked about this before, as much as I love the Sega CD, and as much as I adore the fact that the Sega CD was effectively FMV the console, I cannot deny the fact that the full motion video sequences here were pretty grainy, with very limited colors and a ton of pixels on display. I personally love the charm of old school grainy FMV sequences, but your enjoyment of the original Sega CD version is going to be heavily dependent on how you feel about decidedly non-high definition visuals. Other than the full motion video sequences, the other user interface elements in the game are actually pretty low quality graphics and kind of look like something an amateur artist might whip up in Microsoft Paint. They're effective and they look okay, but I'd be lying if I didn't say the graphics were kind of underwhelming. And by the way, if anyone is wondering, the remaster is an entirely different story, with nicely upscaled remastered video sequences and a user interface that better mimics the whole surveillance security system kind of framework that the game story alludes to. If I were to pick a version of the game to play, I would probably go with the remaster. And in fact, that comment is going to apply as a blanket statement throughout the rest of our discussion. Rather than continuing to say, the remaster does it better constantly, simply recognize that the 25th anniversary edition of the title is the version to play. It is 100% the definitive version of the experience. Moving on to the sound and music, there's not a whole lot of varied music in the title, with most of the soundtrack simply being background music for the action occurring on the screen. And for what it is, those background tracks are totally fine. What transcends those background tracks, though, is the perfectly 80s, super catchy Night Trap theme song, which is actually played during the story itself while the young women inhabiting the house sing and dance along. I mean this unironically. I legitimately really like the Night Trap theme song, and listening to it immediately brings me back to any number of 80s B-movie slasher flicks that, at least for me, are a true guilty pleasure. I know this might not be everyone's cup of tea, and I'd wager a guess that there are a fair number of people who might hear the start of the song and start chuckling to themselves before saying, well, LOLs, what a crazy FMV game. But for me, the theme song is probably my favorite part of the auditory experience of playing the title. Other sounds in the game, primarily the recorded dialogue, are all fine, though you can certainly hear compression artifacts brought about by the limitations of the Sega CD system. Overall, nothing really to complain about with the audio in the game. It's all perfectly fine for what it is, with the Night Trap theme, like I said, being a shining bright spot for me. Moving on to the narrative and story, you are a member of the Sega Control Attack Team, or SCAT, and are part of an operation to investigate and surveil a winery where five teenage girls mysteriously disappeared previously. While the police investigated that incident, their questioning of the family that lives at the winery, the Martins, did not turn up any leads, which is why the case was assigned to the SCAT. Your organization subsequently tapped into the winery's surveillance system, discovering a series of traps throughout the building, along with the previously mentioned surveillance cameras. With the SCAT now controlling the cameras and the traps, an undercover operation is initiated, whereby another group of teenage girls are sent into the winery, with one of them being SCAT agent Kelly Med. It doesn't take long before the winery begins getting assaulted by a group of vampiric creatures known as augurs, and over the course of the game, it's up to you to capture as many of the augurs as possible and save the teenage party from capture and certain death. So this story is pretty much a perfect 80s-style slumber party massacre kind of narrative, and I really enjoyed it. Now, as I've mentioned before, I love cheesy movies, and I really love cheesy movies from the 80s, so I recognize that Night Trap was effectively created to exploit my own personal likes. But I contend that the story is a simple good time for anyone. As long as you're not expecting Academy Award performances or a deep and complex plot, you'll probably enjoy this one. I would be remiss, though, if I didn't mention that actually watching and learning the story requires you to effectively lose the game, since every time you're watching a story sequence, you can almost guarantee a set of augurs are getting away. It's an interesting design decision, and while I kind of wish there was more story readily available while playing normally without having to resort to what amounts to a throwaway playthrough, I still enjoyed it. Moving on to the playability and controls, all of the controls here are very simple, with your only means of interaction being the ability to navigate between different video streams and room cameras, switch the color of the security code for the house's security system, and trigger traps when your trap indicator flashes red. And honestly, with such simple controls, it'd be pretty hard to mess them up, and I can safely say that Night Trap controls just fine. The game also remains a very playable experience, though I do think there will be a little bit of a hurdle some people face, primarily related to the fact that the way to beat the game is to effectively ignore the story and instead focus on finding augurs for capture. Those augur sequences are interesting the first couple times you see them, though you will eventually start to see repeat sequences, and when you couple those repeats with needing to replay the game multiple times, I can certainly see why some people will be less than enamored with the whole experience. Personally, though, I would urge patience, as what I've found is that if you put in some time with the game, you eventually start to uncover a quirky charm that, rather than being irritating, actually becomes endearing, until eventually, you really do want to try to save the teenage slumber party from the augur menace. By the time I was done playing the game, I walked away feeling strangely happy with the experience, and I kind of wanted more. Who knows, maybe we'll take a look at Night Trap's spiritual successor, Double Switch, in the future. Whether we tackle Corey Haim's trap-themed adventure or not, the fact is Night Trap, while simple, is just compelling enough to warrant your attention, and I did enjoy my time playing the game. So overall, how did it feel to play Night Trap in 2024? Well, you know, the game is a very simple, lightweight kind of experience, the kind of thing you'd want to play when you don't want to focus on anything deep or complex. It's kind of the equivalent of casual dating. You're just looking for a good time and some interaction, not necessarily commitment, and Night Trap gives that to you, albeit in video game form. I'd imagine this is even more interesting to play in a group setting, though, as it feels like the kind of game that could be a fun diversion to boot up at a party. It's still fun to play as a solo experience, and I think if you take some time to embrace its quirky charm, you'll definitely find something to like here. So overall, what is our verdict on Night Trap? Now listen, I know Night Trap has in the past been criticized as being one of the worst games ever made. I mean, come on, it has B-movie acting, it's a full-motion video game, and it came out on the Sega CD? That seems ripe for internet critique and general derision. But what I'm telling you is to not believe the haters, as I truly think there's a lot to like with Night Trap. It's not going to win any awards, and I would never consider it one of the best games ever made. But as an early FMV curiosity, there is more good here than you probably assume. Which is why, for me, Night Trap has just become the newest entry on our list of golden oldies. It's a unique, simple experience, but what is here is pretty darn fun, and I think it's something that everyone should try at least once in their gaming careers. Whether you're playing to make fun of it, or because you want to appreciate its oddly eccentric sensibilities, there is some good stuff here, and I have no reservations naming Night Trap as one of our golden oldies.
Tony, this is all insane!
I tried to warn you, but you wouldn't listen.
Listen to what? What are you talking about?
Ashley, I tried to save it from the Oggs, but you had to interfere, and now you will pay.
Tony, I don't understand. This is crazy!
Don't be foolish, Kelly. They wouldn't stand in my way. Would you?
Oh, thanks, Control. That was close.
That was our episode on Night Trap. I hope you all enjoyed listening to it as much as I enjoyed creating it. If you'd like to reach out, let me know how I'm doing, provide feedback, comments, suggestions, or just talk about classic games and technology in general, I would love to hear from you, and there are a few ways you can reach out. I have an X account with the handle @ClassicGamingT, I have an email address, which is ClassicGamingToday@gmail.com, and we have a Discord server. The link is in the show notes. Discord is the best way to get in touch with me and the rest of the community around this podcast. We have a ton of fun out on Discord. I highly encourage you all to check it out today. I also highly encourage everyone to check out our Patreon. It is patreon.com/ClassicGamingToday. So if you want even more Classic Gaming Today goodness, including an exclusive bi-weekly podcast expansion pack, patreon.com/ClassicGamingToday is where it's at. Before we sign off for the week, I do want to mention that our next episode is going to be a Patreon-sponsored episode. This one is going to be focused on EverQuest, the MMORPG that affectionately has been known as EverCrack over the years. We'll talk about that particular drug in the next episode, so feel free to write in if you have any particularly fond or not so fond memories of that experience. At the same time, I recognize you're likely listening to this podcast on any number of podcast services, and if you would feel so inclined, it would be great if you could leave me a review. This is not about bolstering star counts. This is not about trying to harvest a ton of 5-star ratings, though if that happens, awesome, it means we're doing something right. No, what it's really all about is trying to continue to make the best possible podcast I can, and the only way to do that is to get feedback from all of our listener community to make sure that I am hitting that mark. We get new listeners every single day, which is amazing, and I want to make sure that I am continuing to deliver the content that everyone wants to listen to while I continue to try to make the best possible podcast I can. We'll be back in around a week with our next episode focused on EverQuest. Until then, remember, sometimes the games of the past are just as good, if not better, than the games of today. Goodbye, everyone.